Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this August 19th, 2017. And if you'd like to join with us in here with any comments, thoughts, questions, or whatever else you want to talk about, as long as it has something to do with investments or the economy, we would love to have you give us a call at 773-1400. That's 254-773-1400, and we've had a total of exactly zero calls so far during the first hour.
Right, we could double that this hour and still have zero.
We could actually have 10 times that. We could cause it to rise exponentially.
We could do that.
We could have zero squared.
Mm.
Zero times zero, which is still nothing.
It's even if you square a zero, it's still round.
That's it. That's cool. Hey, what else is going on in the big wide world? Well, in the first half of August, before the current brouhaha, the U.S. consumer sentiment rose to the highest level since January. Now, why is that important? Because in January, consumer sentiment was real high on optimism about a new president and great and wonderful things happening in the world. And that was matched by some other things going on. But meanwhile, we have a caller on 773-1400. So you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello.
Yes, sir. Enjoy. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Enjoy the show as usual. Listen, you know, there's that old adage about Wall Street climbs a wall of worry.
It is.
And then what's the other one? When everything is rosy and there's no problems, look out.
That's right. That's as close as anything else.
Sir John Templeton's quote is the bull markets climb a wall of worry. And yeah. I'd like his more extensive quote. Let's see. It's bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria.
So if
we're
find
certainly
any,
in the pessimistic right. time period right now.
If you find any euphoria running around out there, just remember that it's dangerous. In other words, when you hear there's a couple of deadly terms that we always are watching for. One is this could go on forever, and the other one is it's different this time.
Right. And if it could differently go on forever, then we've got real problems.
Yeah, that means that the bottom's about to fall out. So we watch for that. And by the way, at the bottom, you get the same sort of indicator when you see people, well, this is nowhere near the real bottom yet. This could go on forever.
Right.
This could be
the
end of the universe as we know it. Then that means that's the bottom.
Well, I understand. And certainly we're not in the euphoria, but And I know you can't market time and all that, but I mean, what is the VIX? That's at an all-time low.
Yeah, but VIX doesn't measure optimism or pessimism. VIX simply measures volatility. And you can get lack of volatility for two reasons. One, nobody cares. They're just don't care about what's going on. They're ignoring it all. And two, they're shell-shocked. So you either get the shell-shocked, I don't want to do anything because there's too much going on, or the other end of the equation is we're just bored. Well, it's not a very boring time at the moment. So I think there's more shell-shocked than boredom.
Actually, the VIX is no longer at its low point. It's jumped up the last couple of weeks because of the political brouhaha that's going on. But
for those of you who listen to this program but don't know what the VIX is, don't worry. It is not a breath mint. It is the index that measures how bumpy the market is. And when it's at a low point, it means it's flat.
There's
not a lot of bumpiness going on.
And really, the VIX does not measure pessimism.
No.
And so the easiest way to measure pessimism is to read something like the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times or something and note how many people are warning that the market's about to crash. And the more people who are concerned, the safer you are.
One of the interesting factors about the VIX, and I'm really glad you brought this up, caller, the VIX is a great measurement tool. It can be used to look at how hyper aware the market is to any event. If the VIX is really high, then the market is responding very quickly to things. If it's really low, then it's kind of not all that concerned with what's going on in any given moment. This is important, though. If you look back and try to use the VIX as a predictor for almost anything, yes, it fails. It's a great way of looking at how in tuned with how nervous people are at the moment and how much they're willing to buy or sell at any given moment. But it's not good to say how they're going to be buying or selling even tomorrow.
So, caller, you got anything else that you think is indicating that we might be at a top?
Well, I mean, the Wall Street seems like there's been a couple of articles a week for the last really couple of months about things are great. Thank you. Things are great and optimistic, and this thing's going to roll for another 2 years. And, that's just people's opinions. I understand.
Well, actually, what you've got is some very well thought out economic views.
Right.
That say that, for instance, this week, and was going to talk about the leading economic indicators came out, and the leading economic indicators are very consistently, if you don't have the LEI going down, in other words, as long as it's rising, you've got at least 6 months left of bull market, or 6 months left before a recession.
Right, and it's not bull market. We're talking about whether or not the economy is growing, which
right.
tends to influence whether it's a bull or a bear market.
And so you'll see, this is the interesting point. The leading economic indicators came out very, very, very positive on Thursday, and I'll bet you didn't see an article on it anywhere. Because I couldn't find an article on it anywhere. I had to actually go to the conference board to get the information because it just simply wasn't covered anywhere.
It's been rising consistently for so long now that people just – it's not news anymore.
And that is an indication that we're in – it's a double indication that we're in a rising economy and there's no serious danger coming because, very frankly – there are occasional articles saying everything is copacetic and we're in pretty good shape. But for every one of those articles that say that, there are at least 10 articles that says the stock market is overpriced. The bond market might collapse. China's real estate could collapse tomorrow or something like
those
that.
Those are all real threats. We could have a dip in the market, but when we look at the leading indicators on the health of the economy, when we look at the earnings of the market, we just had an absolute record earnings quarter. Best ever type growth. That doesn't tend to precurse a downturn.
And we did not have headlines saying, and I bet you didn't see a headline anywhere, American corporate earnings for the second quarter of 2017 broke all previous records.
Right. Another thing that, I mean,
for
the last 4 years, the United States tax revenue has been at an all-time high. Never been this high before. Now, we're still spending a lot more than we're making. But that statement, when we have an income tax that's proportional – it proportionally goes up the higher your income is. And we have 4 years in a row of record-breaking tax revenue. What that means is that the income is going up for American citizens. And you can look at the numbers and say, income's up. Well, we've heard lots of figures about wages not rising. Well, that's not been true for about 2 years now. And people still say income inequality. They're still talking about something that's based on several years before. Now, where we are in the market cycle, this is just my opinion. You said other people's opinions. I'm going to throw mine out there. I think we're most of the way through the pessimism. We're coming out of pessimism, and there's a lot of optimism that's starting to pop in. Because 2 years ago, you wouldn't have found two articles for every 10 that were optimistic to pessimistic. You would have found zero optimistic articles or one just crazy person that's always optimistic and just always says things are going to go well. When we go forward into this, we were those crazy people at the time, by the way.
We've been accused of that, yeah.
On the other hand, we also called the pessimism on the bear markets before it happened. We looked at real estate bubble and said, that's a bubble. We didn't predict the depth of the burst, but it was certainly something we talked about for a long time. So keeping that in mind, looking around at sentiment, I would say we're beginning to see some optimism coming in here. That means that the beginning of the maturity of this bull is starting, but it's at a very early stage, and it can be shaken any moment by, you know, looking at the Wall Street Journal, and you see lots of articles about dangers from this and dangers from that. That's what really sells news. It takes a lot to get into the optimistic realm of everybody should be doing this, and then the euphoric realm of everyone is doing this, and therefore it's the best idea to do. That's not the way things are. There's a lot of worry still out there. We're still climbing that wall. We may be close to the top of the wall of worry, but we're still climbing it.
One other thing. There was an article yesterday, or maybe it was Thursday, about the builders of apartments or multifamily are starting to cut way back on that, because the demand in the housing is so high. But the problem with that is there's not enough laborers to build the houses. So is this something new, or have we been in that same situation before? I'm going to hang up and listen, guys.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, we talked about that a little earlier, but it is
– we can hit that.
It's worth hitting in. We do have things in the economy to be concerned about, and one of the things – is capacity utilization is really hard to figure at this point. In a cyclical downturn, as opposed to the secular big-time blow-up nuclear weapon downturn.
Anytime you put the word great in front of a recession, that's secular. And if it's just a normal slowdown in business, that's acyclical.
A major secular downturn like we had last time around is not in the works. But at some point, we will get into what's called a cyclical downturn. Cyclical downturns in the economy are generated when we run out of capacity to build things. In other words, we hit the wall on the fact that we simply can't, we don't have the resources.
Right. We either don't have the resources to build it or to get it where it needs to be purchased. So when the railroads get full and the trucks, there's not enough trucks to go around, then that's one form of capacity utilization when we're looking at transportation. Industrial capacity utilization is another area. And then there's simply the ability to buy it at a store. So when a big enough chain goes under and it's not been replaced by something else, then we're missing the sales capacity utilization. None of those are a problem at the moment, but we can start to see them on the horizon.
Yeah, the issue that we are facing today, there's a number of potential hiccups that could hurt the economy right now, but the single largest one is a longer term issue, and that is we have a shortage of both highly skilled and almost no skill, in other words, manual labor and highly skilled people. And unfortunately, this is where the political view could damage the economy. Is both the Republicans, at least in the Senate, and I think they've got support in the House, and the President seem to agree on the idea of cutting the number of immigrants in the United States by about 50%. And the process of doing so, and allowing, for example, people in who have a lot of money, but not allowing low-skilled workers and right now they're in the middle of cutting the visas for high-skilled workers. Those are restrictions on the economy at this point. And when you don't have, when a company like, well, specifically Microsoft, can't get the high-skilled workers that they need to do their job, they shut down a facility in the United States, which they're doing, and they open up a facility, in this case, in Canada. It's more expensive to do business in Canada. But the point is, Canada will allow the high-skilled workers to come in from Asia and stay there and get a reasonable fee. The same thing is true. We need infrastructure, for
example. It's not just Asia, by the way. Now that Microsoft is really getting into electronics, they're hiring a lot of engineers, electrical engineers. And this is a fun little factoid. Graduate students from MIT in electrical engineering, the majority of them are Polish.
Huh.
So they're hiring a lot of Polish engineers.
Current immigration law and policy is when somebody graduates from MIT with a doctorate in electrical engineering, electronic engineering,
go home to Poland.
We force them to return to Poland and won't allow them to stay in the United States and work here, which I think is foolish times squared.
Yeah.
But it was based on, it's a 1960s policy.
Well, this is important. There's a real reason behind it, an emotional reason that has a very valid point. Just like in strategy in the military, we're always planning to fight the last war. What's going on in politics right now with this push to limit legal immigration is that we are fighting the last recession as if it were still the boom before the bust. Because we had a very, very real illegal immigration problem in the United States before the recession. It was a problem in that taxes were not sure to be done correctly. There was forced labor. There's human trafficking. People's jobs were being taken by lower paid people who were being paid illegally, that were here illegally. Well, that pretty much was solved by the market during the recession. The vast majority of the people that were competing in an unfair advantage left the United States during the recession. But that's still the feeling that the pain from the recession was partly brought on by people that were here illegally doing things that were taking directly from the pockets of Americans. That's a real problem, but it's been mostly solved, and it wasn't the legal immigrants that were doing it. So we tend to have a backlash that comes way after the event that comes back and says, hey, we need to get rid of that, when now would be the absolutely perfect time to revise the whole legal immigration policy to recognize the demand from business and the existing workforce in the United States. But because we're still reacting to a flinch that took place 10 years ago, it's unlikely that we're going to get that reform.
And to give you an example of how critical it is, we got a caller coming in. Hang on, caller, be with you just a second. To give you an example of how critical that is, one of the bottlenecks that could restrict growth in the United States, and is on the verge of doing so right now, is infrastructure. We need more infrastructure, highways, railroads, power lines built quicker than we're building them right now. And across the board, contractors who are asked to do this, we can't just throw $1 trillion at it. We could throw $1 trillion at it all day long, but the contractors would say the same thing they're already saying. We don't have enough people, low-skilled, hardworking people who are willing to work outside and get the job done. So we can't do it at the speed that the contract demands. Frankly, we are desperately in need in the United States right now of an immigration reform bill. The Senate passed one about 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, that was excellent. It was well-balanced. It got bipartisan support. It was killed in the House by the what's now called the Freedom Caucus. It was killed in there because it basically said, we need a bunch of people to come that are already here, the people who are already here, who are working, who have clean records get basically a green card, and they get to stay, and they get to apply right. for citizenship.
And that was called amnesty.
But the point is, we can't – our economy, A, can't function without those people, that particular set of people, and B, we need more people coming in. And if we don't accept that and deal with it, we could seriously damage our economy. And right. caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Oh.
They left us.
So 254-773-1400.
There's
still
another
the number to call if the day is August 19th, 2017.
There's another piece to this. We talked about there's two issues that are a threat to the economy in the coming 2 to 5 years. That's infrastructure and lack of low-skilled, high-skilled labor. The third one is something that's a threat to our economy that is a gradual threat that becomes a greater threat about 10 years out. And that is the quality of our K-12 education. There are many metrics that are used to measure that. And over the last 3 decades, we've had 3 decades in a row of falling quality in our education for K-12. At the same time that our universities have gotten better, which puts our kids, our citizen kids, at a disadvantage against foreign people that want to come to our universities.
Absolutely.
Because they're sending the best and the brightest from all over the world, and we're taking a falling quality of education and expecting our kids to compete on an equal footing with the best from everywhere in the rest of the world.
Now I want to switch over to what is typically a conservative perspective, but I'm going to switch over there anyway. The thing about colleges and universities is there is no restriction on where you go.
Right.
And so they compete with each other, and because they compete with each other for the same dollars, they are continuously innovating to have a better outcome. To have a better product at the end.
We don't have competition in the K-12.
Right. In the public school systems, we by and large don't have competition. I mean, you pay your taxes and your kid gets to go to school at that school with whatever they offer. Otherwise, you lose the money and you have to pay privately to go someplace else,
right.
which means, by the way, the private schools where there is competition are turning out superb results. The public schools are, by the way, this is not only happening in the United States, also happening in Europe, are gradually sliding downhill.
And this solves one of the issues, the first two issues that we talked about with infrastructure and then lack of employment. It doesn't solve the lack of manual employment, the manual labor. It does solve the high-skilled problem. If we can provide the high-skilled people here, then let's do it. But we're actively going the other direction at the moment. We've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, this is Rayford and Temple. And I think your statement about we have to import workers that will work outside, if we didn't give about 20% of the population that's perfectly healthy of working age $50,000 a year in welfare benefits and payments, then we would have more people willing to work. Thank you.
I appreciate the call.
I'm going to disagree with you. I think you're working off some very, very old data. Welfare reform done under the Clinton administration chopped that number horrifically. And the people that you're talking about, by and large, are mothers with dependent children.
Right. There's a great website that is out right now. If you go to usafacts.org, this is a billionaire, for-profit, slightly conservative-leaning billionaire, is compiling up-to-date data on people in the United States. And first off, let me say this. 50% of the taxpayers are receiving back more benefit than they're putting in for taxes. But the welfare reform that took place, started during the Reagan administration, came all the way through the first Bush, and part of it took place during the Clinton administration, though it wasn't a Clinton initiative, changed the way that welfare is paid. So there are now tax credits that are given more often than, say, a welfare check. But those tax credits, the major one that replaced much of welfare, was what's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And it literally means that you have to have earned income. Now, you may wind up getting more in the tax credit than you paid in taxes, but you can't get more than you earned. You can't, and that is still a welfare program, but there's some benefits there, and it's not 20% of the population that's receiving it. There are 20% of the working population at any rate. We have a real labor shortage, and that when I'm saying that K through 12, we have some issues with that. It's still good enough that if you're a high school graduate, you understand how to use a computer, you can get a job as a telemarketer. You can get a job as a waiter. You can get a job using a computer somewhere. And if you look at the polls of the millennials that are looking for jobs or that have jobs or that are in a place where they would receive the earned income tax credit, their skills are higher their ability to get a paying job that pays more than that manual labor position, that's the problem, is that they can get paid more in other jobs. You have a point.
Yeah. Let me update your numbers here. Yes. The census 2015, 21.3% of the U.S. participates in government assistance programs.
Right.
However, food stamp recipients, let's just look like that one alone. 47.8% of families receiving food stamps were working, which immediately drops it down to 10%
of the population.
And actually, it's not even that high. There's about 6 or 7% of the population not working and receiving government assistance program. I happen to know some of those people, and they are generally physically disabled where they cannot work.
The largest recipient of government funds are not the unemployed or the welfare. The largest recipient of government funds are Social Security and Medicare recipients. And if that was a program that didn't used to cover as much as it did, and people used to work a lot longer, and I don't expect them to come back and do manual labor. I just don't think so. We've got a lot of standards that were put in place that are just cultural. They're not rule-based standards. But until we can charge more to do the labor of a highway construction or a home construction, which there is a big push against, nobody wants to pay more for that, then we're not going to be able to offer the wages that we need to offer to get a high school graduate to leave an air-conditioned place to come work in construction.
Let me tell you what some of that 21.3% is. If a family is low income and working, and this is not food stamps here, this is another group. If a couple has a couple of kids and their kids are in school in your local school system and they are below a certain income level, then their children receive $1.50 a day of credit to the school system to buy them food. That's government assistance. And when you look at these numbers and the people who say that welfare is way too high and there's way too many people getting welfare. Let me give you an example. Government assistance. Any disabled veteran, no matter what percentage they have of disability, and there's many retired veterans.
They're included in those numbers.
Are retired, and they have a percentage of disability that they get because they were on active duty and they came off active duty and they weren't fully functional for whatever reason. Maybe they had a bad knee or they get headaches. There's a lot of reasons, but many veterans are on a veterans disability program while they're receiving government assistance. So if you go through and actually look at the numbers of people who are receiving assistance, you realize that a very, very, very tiny slice of the American working age population is A, not working, and B, receiving government assistance. And then if you dig down into that, you discover that those people are incapable of working in almost every case. The system is now set up in such a way that if you're able-bodied and you're capable of working and you decide not to work you don't get any money from the government.
Now, let's be clear here. There's still fraud going on. There are still people that don't technically qualify that have gamed the system. But one of the issues on the governmental side, and this is important, the system is always changing. It doesn't matter if you're applying for a contract to do government work or if you're applying for government assistance to do something. The time-consuming process is there to prevent fraud. If you think of all the committees that have to look at a contract and make sure that each standard, each rule has been met, there's still ways to game that system. But the reason why those contracts are so bloated and take so long is because so many people have to look for fraud.
Let me add one other number here. Social Security is government assistance.
That's correct.
So if you're drawing Social Security, you're on government assistance. So when you hear these numbers, these 21% numbers, sure, they sound ridiculous until you sit down and look at the actual numbers behind them and realize that we have a pretty rational system. And again, it's not saying that there's not somebody out there who's gaming the system, but there's somebody who's gaming every system, no matter what the system is.
Here's another one. Subsidized housing is 1% of the family population. Subsidized public housing is 3%. So in total, that 1% is added to the 3%. We've got people on government-assisted housing, either subsidized or public housing, that amounts to 3% of our population. That used to be a lot more. Those are the numbers that we remember when we're talking about this stuff, that, yeah, the public housing projects were not working well and it was causing unemployment in those projects. Well, that's a much smaller percentage these days. Keep that in mind. And as I said, you go to usafacts.org. It has a lot of this data on it. We generally go to all the sources, but it's a nice place to go and have it shown to us quickly.
Let me point out something else, that 4.3 unemployment number that we have. Everybody who is on that is drawing unemployment benefits, just about everybody. And their unemployment benefits are, in fact, government assistance. Therefore, they're part of that 21.3%. So the people who are looking for jobs, if you ever get laid off and you draw unemployment, if you draw Social Security, if you draw Medicare, or if you have parents who are in a nursing home who are on Medicaid to provide for their nursing home, those are all government assistance benefits. And as Jake said, the biggest chunk of it is earned income credits. And earned income credits require the people to be working and to be making a reasonable living. It's just what we have chosen to do is say, and I realize that in some cases they're paying more, but they're getting more back. But the bottom line to earned income is, if somebody is making minimum wage and trying to support a couple of kids in a family and they're trying to make it, the government has said, we're going to return their payroll taxes to them as well as their income taxes to them, because we really don't need to be taxing those people because they're barely making it. So giving them a chance to get ahead is good for them. It's good for the economy. It's good for everybody. It does keep them off welfare and keeps them working. What we want to do, and this is the way the welfare system, if you want to call it the welfare system, the government assistance program is designed today to reward people who are working and do everything possible based on a lot of studies and a lot of experience in this area to keep them working and not make it counterproductive work. We used to have a system. We don't anymore, but we used to have a system where in some cases it would be counterproductive to go to work because you would lose income. And today we've got a system that's pretty fine-tuned where
it still needs constant revision to make sure that we don't compensate people to stay unemployed forever.
Right. But the point is that we do have a limit to how long unemployment runs, and it cuts out at a certain point. And we do have a system where it is more profitable for a person to go to work. They'll make a lot more money going to work than they will by not going to work. And the longer they're off work, the worse their benefits get.
The issue here is that we've done a great job in educating our population. And that education has led to something an older generation might call it an entitlement mentality in our younger generation. Well, they don't feel like they have to get out in a field and work. They don't feel like they need to do construction and work. There's still people doing it. That's who we have doing construction and working in fields. But the reality is that when we can import a population to do that, to keep the prices down, and it's not a direct threat to American jobs, we should. If there's a way that we can make American jobs, say a lower skilled but still higher than the base minimum, to do more work on the construction site, well, that's what I think this we're going to wind up getting. Because as much as we talk about we need immigration reform, it's unlikely to happen. So let's just say it's unlikely to happen. And so therefore, what are we going to do to keep prices reasonable when we're buying a house? And that means new technology will be invented. It's already being invented. Modular homes are being created. Go ahead.
There's something that Jake brought up many, many times over the years, and it's that I didn't know about until he said it, and I went back and checked it. If you take that 21.3%, it is not the same 21.3% that was receiving government assistance 5 years ago.
Correct.
And what happens is, and there's a few
just
things,
like the 1% that earn the most are not the
right.
same 1% year after year.
One of the things that's happened, and this is just a reality, and it runs against political ideology, I realize that, but we actually have a pretty good system of government support. And the reason I say that is when a family gets on earned income credits and they're in a position where they're getting unemployment or whatever government support program they're on, other than total physical disability, what happens is within a few years, they're back out of it and making more money because the government, the system, the unemployment, the Texas Workforce Commission pays close attention to those people. And they pay attention to them because it comes out of the Texas budget to help take care of those people. The government, the federal government's involved, but Texas is involved too. So they become a priority to get better educated or better in a position where they can get a better paying job. And within 5 years, typically, they're not on what you would call welfare anymore. We've got a lot of things wrong in this country. We've got a lot of things we could do better in this country. But I think we have refined the so-called welfare system to a point where it needs some fine-tuning, perhaps, but it starts to become counterproductive. We've all seen, or at least I've seen, a case where I'm standing in line. I was standing in line at Whole Foods store, of all places, in Austin, and the woman in front of me was buying a bunch of junk foods, and she used a chip card, which means she's buying on the government nickel.
It's a stamp card, basically.
A food stamp card. To buy a bunch of what was clearly junk food. And then she and her young boyfriend went out and got in an extremely expensive car and drove off. Well, yeah, that's wrong. And when I see that, it ticks me off. But in fact, they're not married. She has children. And the objective is to see to it that the children don't starve to death. Now, I'm of the opinion we should limit the type of food that can be bought under the CHIP program. That's an example of a fine-tuning of this thing that I think would work a lot better. But that is something that the legislature could do and hasn't done for some reason, meaning the federal and state legislatures. They have chosen to keep the junk food, and there's a reason for that, and the reason for it has nothing to do with socialism. It has to do with the lobbying by the junk food manufacturers to say, oh, yeah, you've got to allow them the freedom to buy garbage for their kids. I really think that if we were to change the CHIP program, the food stamp program, to where reasonably healthy food is the only kind you could buy, we would improve the situation. But that's the kind of fine-tuning that needs to be done. But it doesn't solve the problem of having a lot of people to build highways and single-family homes.
Right.
That woman, that mother of those children, is not going to go out
and
build a highway because, right. among other things, she may have three kids at home. And those and the daycare will cost more than she would make working on the highway.
So again, unless we're willing to pay more for infrastructure than we have traditionally, and that's something that's crept up dramatically over the years, and this is a really easy way to look at it. If you think of, well, here's a great example. I went to Colorado a couple of weeks ago. It was fantastic, and you avoided the heat of summer here in Texas. So went to Colorado, and in Colorado, we went to a co-op grocery store just as we came into Trinidad in Colorado. First little town, beautiful place. And this grocery store was built in a late 1800s Main Street building. And I went inside it, and the construction is stone and concrete. It's got two stories, and it's probably 7,000 square feet. It was built at a time when it was expensive to build it, but the number of people available to do it was high. They could take from the population in the local area very easily, give people jobs who'd never had a job doing that thing before, and have them build a building for what we would consider a very low amount of money. Your house, old Baldy, Jeff, built in Salado, and I have spoken to people who were teenagers when it was built and who helped make the roof on it. Teenagers from the local high school came out and put a roof on a house that was a new construction. Well, we've got one regulatory issues that won't let that happen anymore because it was a steep peaked roof.
It's a miracle none of them were killed.
Right. And now we say, hey, if you fall down and hurt yourself, then your employer owes you a lot of money. And so there's that saying that the employer is not going to hire people that have never done this before to put that roof on. Well, that means that there's a certain standard. You can't hire kids to do dangerous work. And it costs more to do that work. It costs a lot more to do that work. However, throw in the fact that we don't have the ability to hire teenagers to build our roadways until they're 18. We don't have the ability to hire the neighborhood kids to come and help us build a house without putting ourselves at great liability. We as a people, through tort and through law, have said that we can't put kids in danger. We can remove that regulation as we have, if we as a people say it's okay to do that now for the price involved, or we can develop what we're doing already, the technology to do the same work for the same price without endangering people. And we've got a caller coming in on 773-1400. Caller,
you're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Hello. Caller. Hello, caller.
We lost him.
Scared him off. I wonder what happens with that.
Well, they probably were calling. It was a telephone call. Somebody said, well, I'm going to ask him a question. And then, oh, no, I don't want to ask him a question. We're on the air.
I guess it happens. Hey.
Oh, here okay, we go.
Here we go. One more time under the breach, dear friend. Caller, you're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Hey, I was just listening to you guys, and I didn't quite drive off the road, but I was very fascinated with your analysis of Social Security as a government assistance program.
It is. When you look at the 21.3% that's reported by the census, Social Security is included in that number.
Right. So we look at it and we say, that's how the government's reporting it. Well, I don't consider it an assistance program, but that's how the government reports it.
But it's clearly not an assistance program if you don't participate in the minimum amount of time for it. I mean, it's not welfare.
No,
you
no.
Guys were
but people.
Okay, so would you look at it as welfare?
Look at the 21. The guy called in earlier and
they said 20%.
21. He said 20%. Yes, in the census in 2015 came out with a number. It says 21.3% of Americans receive government assistance. Well, that basically means that the government of the United States pays 21.3% of the population who are not working for the government. They
right.
pay them something, and Social Security,
no,
military retirement, welfare, all of those fall into that heading.
they're not welfare.
No.
No, but people call it welfare.
And when somebody says 20%, that's the only number that we can come up with that says, and we have to say that's not what that is.
Real welfare is actually only being paid, as we know, welfare is actually only being paid to about 6% of the population.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit higher because of state Medicaid programs now.
If you call that welfare. But the point is, Medicaid does not pay them money and put them in their pocket. Welfare used to be a situation where people got paid money to spend as they will because they were considered to be disadvantaged. Well, that's almost vanished from our system.
Well, and it was generally only paid to people that had small children, and the largest welfare program was aid for dependent children.
Right.
Yeah, and so if you really take apart that 21.3%, you discover that who are you going to remove from that system, and what would happen if you remove them, and you suddenly realize there's practically nobody there that you could pull out without damaging the economy and causing real damage to people.
We certainly don't think that Social Security, even in its disability form, is a form of welfare, because you can't get Social Security disability unless you've earned money and paid towards Social Security. That's just a fact. And the whole concept of paying into Social Security, it is a governmental system that's designed to pay out more than it receives over a long period of time, and that's a problem.
SSI does not require you to have ever paid into the system. Then it is what we would call welfare. But it boils down to the fact you have to be totally and permanently disabled where you cannot work and you own nothing of value. You basically have to be really, really, really poor, A, and B, have no capacity of working in the workplace, and then spend a lot of months waiting on it and going through the testing and everything to get it. That's welfare. But it's welfare to totally disabled people to keep them from starving to death.
And SSI will be larger than the Department of Defense budget within a couple of years.
It could be. I doubt it. I don't even – I know. No,
not within a couple of years. The SS, and there's some good numbers on that. USAfacts.org is great for that. SSI is the smallest component of the Social Security area. There's Social Security Disability Insurance is the next smallest, and then what they pay to retirees. And SSI, as being the smallest component, is not growing rapidly because we are finding ways of preventing disability.
I don't know who said SSI would be the equivalent of the defense budget, but if you look at there's no comparison between.
Now,
you guys are forgetting the Medicare payments that come along with it. 15% of Medicare.
But that's.
No, not Medicare, Medicaid.
Medicaid.
No, it's Medicare. It's under subchapter 18, not 19.
Okay, got you.
Security. Yeah, it's Medicare is. And. If you go to hospitals, you look at that, it's a huge growing part of Medicare. And that all those people only qualify for Medicare because of their SSI relationship.
I got you. I hear what you're saying. Yeah, so your health care benefits. But again, health care, when we talk about welfare, we're talking about giving money to people to spend as they will because they're poor. And that used to be welfare. And I remember when we literally – there were welfare checks people got.
Right. And what that is that the states pay the Medicare premiums for the people that are getting SSI that also receive Medicaid. So we're getting into a nitty-gritty here. It is a smaller section. Now, there are some numbers that are correct in what you were saying there in that, for instance, retirement pay to military veterans is larger than active duty pay now, and will in the not too far distant future, about 8 years from now, will be more than the current defense budget.
Yeah,
that may be what you've heard.
I think if you go back and look at some of these programs, like the disability program, if you take all of the costs associated with, which includes the health care, which you can call that as a non-payment, but it's a transfer of wealth from one group to another group through the government. So you call that what it is. It is, but it's a transfer payment. And it's into the hundreds of billions now, that program. And that's again, you know, you're talking about when you start splitting this apart, and if you transfer money from one group to another, you can call that welfare. At least within Social Security, it at least nominally is from the pool of participants. Nominally.
Right. Well, SSI, there's a lot of ways of looking at this, and we could kind of beat this horse into the ground. I appreciate the call, and I'm thankful that you've...
We'll take a great day. I'm going to take a look at that and come back with some solid numbers on
that. We appreciate the call. This is the sort of thing, informed conversation is what we're looking for on here. And transfer payments from the government are quite high. SSI's transfer payments are less than Social Security as a whole. Medicare, when you throw that in, and as with and Medicaid, it's still smaller than Social Security, and it's not growing as fast as the retirement population is with Social Security. That being said, there is a growing problem with that whole government transfer process. It's one of the things that we have to develop a fix for into the future. We're already on the negative side when it comes to Medicare. We have been for the past 7 years. We've been at a point where we're paying out more in Medicare than we're receiving in Medicare taxes.
Did we do commercials?
We've got to play some real quick.
We got 5 minutes left.
All right. So we will play the commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call and talk. It won't be any time. So we'll talk on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach for just about a minute and three quarters or thereabouts, and with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're cruising down towards the end of our August 19th, 2017 second hour, and we'd like you to know that we appreciate any of you who dare to listen. And we really appreciate some of the thoughtful calls that we got in here today, and we are available. You can reach me, Jeff, at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We have a telephone number you can call locally if you'd like to talk to us, you'd like to make some suggestions to our staff, or leave a message as to what we might want to talk about, or talk to us about investment management. And it is 254-947-1111 or...
Toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Our webpage is thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. And on that page, you can read our newsletter. You can sign up for receiving the newsletter every week. You can listen to our podcasts of this program and many, many more going back into the dark ages of history. You can read our philosophy, see our made-for-radio faces, and our beautiful staff. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we didn't get to talk about this week that
there always
we'll
is.
Just have to save till next week.
But
so
all in all, the economy's looking good and politics are looking rough, and that's where we're going to end the show. Until next week, this has been The Personal
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.